And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation. With Sean Engel. And Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. I don't know what episode number that is, but it's Season 2, Episode 2. I am Andrew Leyland, and as always, I am joined by my two illustrious co-hosts, mainly because they just won't go away, Mr. Paul Spataro.
Hi-yo.
And Mr. Sean Engel. How you doing, fellas?
Doing well, Andy.
I'm awake now.
So it just takes recording an entire episode to wake you up.
By the time we get to the second recording session, I'm awake. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Every other episode, I should get a review as to how I'm doing.
See, that's weird because it works the exact opposite way. I'm usually up for the first episode because I've had my coffee, and then I'm starting to fade by the second one. So if you notice a slowdown in my speech pattern, or you'll hear, violent snoring, that's me.
Or hear your head hit the desk as you fall down.
Luckily, I haven't pulled the shag yet.
Well, even though it's...
Would you want to?
Well, no, I wouldn't want to pull a shag, because that sounds incredibly filthy.
Well, we are in very different situations, even though our time zones are only 1 hour apart, because you're waiting to go to bed for the evening of sorts.
Yep.
And I just had to get up early to do this, so we are in opposite camps as far as sleep patterns go.
Yeah. But we talk about this every time that we get on the show, and it's not that we're complaining about it, because we love talking about this, but it's just one of those things. It's just the nature of the beast here. But it's always great getting to talk with you guys, especially about these Star Trek episodes.
You know, if you fired that British guy, you two could just record this whenever.
No.
It's like I told you, though, because of the time we do it at... It's, the negative of it is that I have to set my alarm and get up to do it. But the positive is it does not interfere with any other activities. I don't have to worry about, am I going to be able to, juggle what I'm doing to do this? So I see it as a plus. Back to the bins, we're always trying to figure out, okay, what night is good for us to record? When can we record it? This week, it's okay, Saturday morning, get up.
Yeah, the same here with me. It's just, that I have a specific time when I'm going to, that I know that I'm going to be recording. It makes it so easy. It's just be there, be ready with your notes, be ready to talk about stuff, and you're good to go. So this is perhaps one of the most fun series that I do, because I know exactly when I'm going to be doing it, and it's like clockwork. Every time we're getting ready to record, we get ready to do it, and it's done. So it makes it a lot more fun than trying to have to work things out like with other shows. When I do the Who True Freaks, it's like, okay, when can you be here? When can you be here? Okay, you're over in the UK. We have to work that time schedule in so you're not up too late and we're not up too early and all that. So this works out perfectly for me.
You won't be saying that in another hour when you're dozing off.
Yeah, well, like I said, the coffee's still working. So just wait. Just wait for a while.
All right, well, we don't really have any news to discuss this time, do we?
No,
well,
not really.
Well, the closest I would come is I have, sitting on my dresser right now, copy of issue 4 of Star Trek Planet of the Apes. And I have not read this issue yet, so I'm just looking forward to at some point having a little downtime that I could just sit down and read that. So far, I'm enjoying the series. We are planning on dedicating an episode of Back to the Bins to it once the series is completed. My advance is so far so good.
Do we know how many episodes or how many issues it's going to be? Because I'm thinking about waiting for the trade.
It's either 5 or 6. I'm not certain.
Yeah, like
most of those is it IDW?
Yeah, it's IDW.
Most of those IDW miniseries are 6 issues.
Yeah,
I think you're probably correct.
Yeah, I'm. I know you recommended that this might be a wait for the trade one, and I've already talked to my LCS and had them, when the trade comes out, they're going to get it for me. So I'm looking forward to picking up when it gets traded. But, you know,
I like about it is, you know, we had Planet of the Apes month, and we did, we did so many issues of the Planet of the Apes comic books in that month. And I enjoyed a lot of the ones that we covered. But except for an adaptation of movies, this is probably the first time I'm actually seeing the character of Colonel Taylor in a comic series. And I'm really enjoying that.
Looking forward to picking it up. Like I said, I'm waiting for the trade paperback, because it looks like a typical IDW book, and it looks like I've paid, because it's quite expensive because it's an indie book. Although they're just as cheap as Marvel and DC now.
Yeah,
it does look like I'd have it read in 4 minutes.
It's not a long read, but so far, once I read them, I feel satisfied with the issues as I'm going. I do think it's going to be better served to sit and read it in one sitting when it's out on trade, but it doesn't leave me with that "oh, nothing happened" feeling.
Yeah, I think that's the key, isn't it? It's not how much has it cost versus how much I actually got to read. It's how much satisfaction did it give me for that cost.
Yeah, I think that's huge. But if it was cheaper, if these books were a dollar each, and you read one and it didn't satisfy, you know, your total geek gene, or you'd say, well, I paid a buck, I don't care. It's when you pay $5 for it and it does that you say, you know, that's a lot of money to spend for a book that really didn't do anything for me.
Indeed.
Yes.
Should we go straight into the episode then?
Kira is forced to resign.
What do you want me to do, Odo?
Fight for what you want!
Now she's a pawn in a rebel plot.
How can you betray your own government?
We are all patriots, Commander.
But who's really behind this devious plan?
Where would the Circle be getting so many weapons?
What will the Federation do?
We gotta leave!
If we withdraw, we'll be giving Bajor and the Wormhole back to them.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yep, yeah, I don't have any Star Trek, so let's do it.
Seeing as I have the synopsis, and by I have the synopsis, I mean I went to all the effort of walking over to my bookshelf and picking up a copy of the Deep Space Nine Companion by Terry J. Urban and Paula M. Block, which is more difficult than one would think, because I've somehow managed to pull my little finger back, and now my right hand's really sore. So lifting up this heavy book, you lovely listeners do not know the trouble that we go to bring you this show. Quite frankly,
we spare no expense.
We spend no expense. The Circle was written by Peter Allen Fields, who created Barney Miller, the $7 Million Man. It's wild, Steve, wild! A great episode, go and check it out. It was directed by Corey Allen. The guest cast included a returning Richard Baymer and Frank Langella from last time, but Stephen Macht is in this episode. He was almost Captain Picard. And he's interviewed about that on the Blu-ray releases for the first season of The Next Generation, which is well worth checking out if you ever see them for cheap. But also a little note, Mike Genovese is in this episode, who was the Flash's boss in the 1990 Flash TV show.
Look who's bringing all the geek knowledge today. Nice.
I didn't have to look any of that up.
Look at the big brain on Andy.
Some would say it was sad that I didn't have to look any of that up. Obviously, Louise Fletcher as well returns as Vedic Wynn. Always a pleasure to see her on the show. The synopsis goes something like this. When Commander Sisko angrily confronts Jarrow about the decision to send Kira back to Bajor, the Bajoran minister expresses his surprise, noting that it's no secret Kira's presence on the station has been troublesome for Sisko. Sisko denies the allegation and defends Kira, but it is his turn to be surprised when Jarrow informs him that Kira's removal will mean a promotion for her, as thanks for rescuing Lee Nalis. Jarrow further placates Sisko by explaining that Lee will be safer on the station than in Bajor's volatile capital. A short time later, Sisko is unpleasantly reminded of the planet-side violence when he discovers the Circle's graffito insignia on the door to his quarters. As Kira sadly packs for her departure, she is interrupted by the non-stop arrival of her friends from the station. Amid the confusion of several different conversations all taking place at once, Odo encourages her to fight for her job, but Kira is resigned to her fate. And when Vedic Barail arrives with an invitation to spend some time at his monastery, Kira is delighted to accept. Before she departs, however, Sisko promises that he will fight to have her reinstated. At the monastery, Kira finds it difficult to occupy herself with useless pastimes, nor is he sure of how to deal with her growing attraction to Barail, which he senses is mutual. After an encounter in the temple garden, the young Vedic finds Kira to the chamber within the monastery and shows Kira the Orb of Prophecy and Change. Left alone with the sacred relic, Kira experiences a vision. She finds herself in the Bajoran Chamber of Ministers along with Dax, Vedic Wynn, Jarrow and Barail. The room appears to be in chaos and Dax urges her to listen to the babel of legislators' voices. As she tries to comprehend them, Kira realizes she is naked, as is Barail, who embraces and kisses her. The vision ends abruptly, leaving both Kira bewildered and intrigued. On the station, Odo learns that the insurrection on Bajor is becoming more and more serious. According to Quark, the Circle is receiving weapons and explosives from the Cressare. Odo decides to investigate the Cressare, while Sisko goes to Bajor to discern whether or not Bajor's military will support the radical Circle movement over the planet's Federation-friendly provisional government. But the general with whom he meets, Krim, seems undecided. Before he returns to the station, Sisko visits Kira at the temple and warns her about the impending coup. A short time after he leaves, Kira is drugged and kidnapped by three masked men. Odo's investigations lead to an odd discovery. The arms that the Cressare are supplying to the Circle are coming from the Cardassians. At the same time, Kira makes an equally shocking discovery. She has been kidnapped by Jarrow, who is the power behind the Circle. Jarrow believes that his efforts will unite Bajor with the power and strength it needs to survive, although first he must get rid of the Federation's presence. When Sisko refuses to give him information about Sisko's plans, Jarrow has her beaten. Back at the station, Quark announces that he has discovered where the Circle's headquarters is. Sisko takes a small team to the location and rescues Kira. Odo reveals to Sisko and the others what he has discovered, and the group quickly discerns that the Cardassians are supplying the arms so that the Circle's coup will get rid of the Federation. And with the Federation gone, the Cardassians will be able to retake Bajor for themselves. On Bajor, unaware that he is a pawn in a larger scheme, Jarrow congratulates Wynn on their impending success, which is surely the first step toward her becoming the new Kai. As Sisko attempts to put Lee Nalis in touch with Bajor's Council of Ministers to tell them the truth, but the communications with the planets have been severed. Contacting Starfleet, Sisko briefs Admiral Chakotay on the situation. With a revolution about to begin and the assault ships from Bajor headed towards DS9, the Admiral orders Sisko to evacuate immediately. But Sisko has something a little different in mind. And I apologize for making that hard work for Sean to edit.
Oh, it'll all come out in the wash. It's all good.
He's just going to leave it as it is.
Yeah, why not? The explicit tag up and all the profanity will just...
That foul-mouthed John Constantine wannabe again.
No, I usually try and... I think there may be an episode that came out a little while that I might have let an F-bomb slip, but I try and keep the episodes PG-13, and it's not a big editing chore, so it's all good. What'd you think of this one?
I like this one a lot. I think it's a very good continuation of the story. It escalates the plots that were all set in motion in part one exceptionally well. It's not really that big of a surprise that Jarrow's the bad guy, but it's handled well. And the moving of the characters around gives us a nice change to the dynamic by making Lee Nalis, giving Lee Nalis Kira's position on the station. All of that's brilliant. And there's some great characterization. And it's, like I say, it escalates the story really well. Normally part two is weak at the weakest of the lot, but in this case it isn't.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think they really built on things. I think the addition and the collusion between Wynn and Frank Langella's character,
Minister Gero,
yeah, between those two guys, between those two people, are just, it's just wonderful. Every line that Louise Fletcher says throughout this just drips with condescension, especially when she's meeting with Kira as she's walking along with Vedic Barile in the little arboretum or whatever, and she gives her the line, "Oh, you're here to learn about your paw, to study your paw. Well, feel free to stay as many days as you like, even a week if necessary." She's just brilliant in how
yeah, but don't stay longer than that.
Exactly. It's her saying, "Oh, stay as long as you want, so long as it's just a week." And her condescending tone is just like a sort of patronizing school teacher, just one of these people you just want to punch. She's so good at being evil, and I want to see more of her character. And it's Deep Space Nine, like I've said, with the Cardassians and the political intrigue on Bajor, has some of the best thought out villains in all of Star Trek, and it's just glorious to watch them on the screen.
She's the queen of passive aggression.
Mm-hmm.
I adore Louise Fletcher in this episode. I think she was just, like you said, brilliant. She's just, you know, you totally see through everything she's doing, but you still don't know exactly why she's doing what she is. You know, she's not a mustache twirling villain, but she's clearly a villain, and she doesn't even really try and hide it that much. And yet her attitude is always, as you said, condescending, that she's, you know, she knows better than you, so you got to keep your mouth shut because of it. Oh, she's just wonderful. And it's just, you know, she won the Academy Award for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is, I think, one of the greatest movies of all time. And yet I think her performance is even better here.
Well, she's given such a broader role to act with, and she's given so much more to do with the character. As much as I enjoyed her character in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that was just her being limited to like a 2-hour movie. Yes, it was great, but she gets to play that sort of deceitful, conniving character and just amp it up to 11, and you know, take it throughout all of this series, and it works so well. And from what I've heard, Louise Fletcher in real life is one of the nicest, or you know, unfortunately she's passed away, was one of the nicest people around, but she can portray some of the most unlikable people, but unlikable in such a way that they're interesting. Is she? I thought she had passed away.
She's 80 years old.
Is this another installment of Aren't They Dead?
I
just looked her up quickly because I was like, she died?
I could have sworn.
She's 80 years old. She's still alive as far as her internet entry says.
Well, son of a bitch. Well, I pulled the Scott Gardner there then. Oh, well.
I thought she died ages ago.
That'll get Scott listening to the show. We mention him on there. So there you go.
Four listeners! Yay!
Four listeners. I mean, I just think she's tremendous. More of the same as far as Frank Langella goes. Again, no surprise that he's the... what a shock. He turned out that he's not pure. I mean, he came out right in the first episode saying, you know, "I'm a politician. You have to let me have my moments." So, I mean, he didn't even try and hide it either. But what I love is that, like, him and Louise Fletcher are villains, and they don't try and hide it, but they're also not mustache twirling. They still are people who clearly think they know the right thing to do. They know better, and that's why they're doing this. It's not because they say, "Ooh, let's form the Society of Evil." You know what I mean? There's nothing like that going on.
Well, and it's always the case that the best villains are always the ones who think that they are doing the right thing. And yeah, this is a case of it. This is a perfect case of it.
Absolutely. Especially if you're going to have a long-term villain. You can have a short, you know, one movie, one episode villain. You know, my mind goes to Scorpio in Dirty Harry, who is just basically pure evil with no motivation of good whatsoever, and he could be one of the greatest villains of all time. But if you're going to have Dirty Harry, the series, and have it on for 5 years where Harry Callahan's chasing Scorpio the whole time, you're going to have to make him more nuanced and tell us what his motivations are to some extent. And that's, you know, Louise Fletcher is a long form villain here. She's going to be with us for the entire series. You know, and at this point, I would say she is overshadowing Mark Alamo as a villain, and that's no small feat.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that surprised us about going this far, though, is how little Mark Alamo's been in it so far. Given what he will become, it is quite a surprise. He's only been in two or three shows so far, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. And he hasn't, I don't think he's even been... No, he was on the station in like the pilot episode, or one of the earlier episodes in season one. But most of the time, the dealings that they've had with Mark Alamo have been via view screen or communication. They haven't been any face-to-face interaction, really, aside from that or those earlier episodes. And, you know, Wynn has been up front with all the people on the station, with Sisko, with Kira. You know, she's so far a more recognizable, more upfront villain than Gul Dukat has been. So yeah.
Now, in this episode, Bruce Gray plays Admiral Chakotay. Do they ever make reference to whether or not he is related to Chakotay from Voyager?
Differently in the Deep Space Nine Companion as it is from Chakotay on Voyager. In the Deep Space Nine Companion, it's spelled C-H-E-K-O-T-E, which is a different spelling of Chakotay from the opening credits of Voyager. So it's from that we can infer that they're not related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I heard it mentioned, I actually, for some reason, had the captions on when I was watching this on my computer on Netflix, and I did notice that the spelling was different. So it did kind of surprise me the first time. I was thinking, oh, well, maybe there is a relationship, but no, with the spelling, it's different.
Maybe where they come from, Chakotay is like Smith.
That could be it.
Possibly. It would have been nice if they were related. That would have been a nice little touch of continuity that they didn't even have to address. They could just say, you know, producers could say, yeah, they were related.
Yeah,
we're not going to make anything of it.
But then they're nitpicking nerds like us going, well, what's their relationship? Is he like the grandfather of Chakotay, or what's happened with this? So
I can honestly say I wouldn't care.
But that's the kind of thing where they can do it and have us fixate on it, and yet it has no impact on the actual series that they're producing, and you'd think they would like that. It gives them more focus on their show.
And if somebody to write a novel about it, you've got something to go off there.
There you go.
I didn't have a lot of notes on this episode, but the one note I had is that you give Kira an orb, and she gets the orb version of internet porn.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that in the Star Trek Deep Space Nine universe that the analog for priests still like to get naked and do it with members of their church. So, yeah, take
that
for what you will.
When the member of the church looks like Kira, who can blame it?
Well, that's true. And not to take anything away from Brile himself, I mean, I think one of the things that they decided to do that I think was a good choice was make Brile a sort of young, attractive, you know, outgoing person, rather than having him sort of an analog, like a male analog to Louise Fletcher, who's more of an older, sort of a stoic character. Brile has more of a vigor and an energy to him, and that's a nice contrast to the way Wynn is.
Mm.
And plus, yeah, like... it allows him to get naked with Kira, so that's nice too.
I like Sisko's scene with Jaro as well, where Sisko basically says, you're a politician, you're full of shit.
Oh, yeah.
He says it a lot more eloquently than that, because he tells him that story about the guy who's full of hot air, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what he's saying to him. He's making it quite clear, I don't trust you, I don't like you, and I actually quite like Kira, even though you think that I don't.
Yeah. Well, And Sisko throughout this show is really doing a great job. He's being very subtle with his acting. I also would like to comment on, you know, where he went down to Bajor and was talking with the military commander who was played by Stephen Macht. Was that who the guy? And he was supposed to be, he was up for the role of Captain Picard.
He was very nearly Captain Picard.
And, you know, the interplay that he had with that character and basically telling him about the Cardassians, or telling him about the Lecepians trying to smuggle arms for the Circle and all that, and giving that up before asking about having Kira back. I mean, it's good interplay between him as a competent commander with this leader of the military forces on Bajor. I like that. One of the things that I don't know, I'd like to get your guys' take on it, was the sort of opening scene in Kira's quarters where everyone comes in and it's like a Neil Simon play where everyone just comes in and does their little, you know, it's good to see you, and Odo's all riling about, you know, she should fight this and she shouldn't go quietly, and Dax is trying to be conciliatory, and, you know, Quark comes in and being kind of lecherous with a bottle of wine for her, and what did you guys think about that little scene?
I thought it was brilliant.
It brought to mind for me the stateroom scene from the Marx Brothers.
Oh, yes.
Where the people just keep coming in and coming in and coming in, and eventually it's so crowded that they're, like, passing people along the top and stuff. And I thought it was played lighthearted. I don't think they wanted to give the message of showing that there is a true camaraderie among these people, but they didn't want to make it, you know, like, overly syrupy and you know, maudlin, because everybody knows that she's going to be back on the station anyway, so it would have almost had a false note to it. So I think they played it perfectly, because I think they did do it lighthearted, but they did kind of show that she's respected and liked among her peers.
Well, and she even at the end, you know, when Vedic Barile comes in, and, you know, she introduces all of these people as her friends. You know, she has the respect of all of them, and she respects them back in the same way. I agree. I thought it was a really good comedic yet touching scene, and I think they pulled it off really well.
Apparently, they did it all in one take.
That's pretty impressive.
The director wanted to use, because they're all stage actors, aren't they? And that's the take the director wanted to use, and the producer said, no, it's television, we need coverage. So they made him retake bits for close-ups and stuff, but he wanted to put in the version that was just, they rehearsed it all and then they all just did it, and that's the one he wanted to put in the episode, but he got overruled.
That's disappointing, because I think they pull it off really well, and that's, you know, mentioning that they are all stage actors, and that's kind of what it felt like. It felt like a scene from, like, a George Bernard Shaw play or a Neil Simon play, or, like you said, what was it, Night at the Opera with the Marx Brothers. So, yeah.
Yeah, it almost belied the serious nature of a lot of the rest of the episode, but it was just kind of a nice little lighthearted moment early on, almost to relieve some tension before it builds up as it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, you know, just, if I had to describe this episode, I would just say solid. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to say great. I'm not going to say groundbreaking or, you know, anything else. Just a very solid episode, which I think makes it a nice continuation of what we had in the first episode. It's kind of in many ways more of the same. Just keeps moving it along.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. There's nothing really groundbreaking. There's nothing, aside from the collusion between the political party and, you know, that political party of Minister Jarrow being in league with the sort of, for lack of a better term, the terrorist group on Bajor, and his sort of collusion with the religious order that Vedic Wynn is aligned with. It's more political intrigue. It's more religious intrigue. It's just a good continuation of what we had from the first episode.
Yeah, it's like Paul says. It's a good solid episode. It's a good continuation of the previous one. I think they do work better when you watch them back to back. And like I did with these two for doing these two episodes. I wish I'd carried on and watched part three, but I didn't because I was falling asleep. Because it does seem like it would be a solid 2-hour episode if you stitched them all together.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have anything else on this one? Any more points?
Did anyone see Morn in this episode? Because I looked.
Yes.
Okay.
he's in one of those scenes when I think they order the evacuation. He's very small in the bottom of the right-hand corner of the screen, but he is there.
Okay, I'm going to have to go back and look, because like the last episode, I looked and looked and looked and didn't see him. Is it? So you said it's near the evacuation, so it's the end
episode. It's a blink and you'll miss him crowd scene.
See, that's where they've had in other episodes, so I'm glad that he is back at least for this episode, because I was just really sorely disappointed that he wasn't in the last one.
Yeah, I again did not see him in this one, but I'm glad Andy did.
I'm certain I saw him. I double check it, but I'm sure he was just in one of those. He just like blunders past right in the bottom corner of the screen. He doesn't even get a walk past properly. I'm sure he was there.
Well, I'll go check it out and make sure, because this is for posterity. I mean, this Listen to the Prophets Excel sheet is gonna go up on the internet with our show notes eventually, and it's going to determine how we feel about this show. So, internet and, posterity.
Just a small thing, but I like when they're talking and Sisko is bouncing a baseball around in his hands while they're talking. It just seems so real.
I always like when the people who visit him pick it up and play with it.
Yeah, when they're kind of...
Which is also very real, because that's what would happen in...
would happen. But also, I like the different actors' way of doing it. Like, Jaro picks it up and doesn't quite know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
He's just turning it around in his hand like he doesn't know what it is. I always like how the different actors do it, because they're used to picking up props and working with them to make the scenes real. So I do wonder if they're ever given any direction by Avery Brooks as like, yeah, I'm a baseball fan, baseball doesn't exist in the 24th century, but you definitely wouldn't know what it was. And then he picks it up and goes, all right, well, I'll play with it like it's a stress ball or something.
The only other thing that I wanted to say again was the scene between Quark and Odo in his office. Again, Quark and Odo are my favorite characters on the show, and where Odo essentially enlists Quark to be his deputy, and the just reaction that Quark has to that, it's just so joyous for me that this is, and also that he's blackmailing him into doing it as well. It's like I said, the Rick and Louis sort of feel of the characters is what really makes it for this show. That's about all I have for notes on this.
The nice thing is that you got to think that Quark actually probably respects Odo more because he blackmails him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the scene at the with Quark and Rom, one for you, six for me. One for you, six for me. Well, that's not very fair. You are absolutely right. One for you, seven for me.
poor Rom. Well, he'll get his own. Eventually. So, do we have anything else we want to talk about on this one?
No, it was just a good, entertaining, solid episode. I really enjoyed watching it.
Agreed.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, who wants to go first with their ratings?
Well, it's Andy's episode.
Okay,
I'll step up to that. I think this one was another 3.5. I think it carried the storyline on very, very well. It's slightly better than part one, because everything's in motion now. So everything's been set up and you're moving into act two and then on into act three, but not enough to push it up to a 4.
I'm slightly of a different thought. I think, you know, it's a very solid episode. I really enjoyed it. I'm not going to say I think it's slightly better than episode one. It may be slightly better because things are happening in it, but as is often the case in a three-part thing, it suffers slightly from having had to see the episode before it and having to see the episode after it. It doesn't really feel self-contained. Even though part one was part one of three, it had more of a self-contained feeling to it because of the lack of a big cliffhanger at the end. This one really feels like the continuation of a story, and that it's continuing on, and I know that's the goal of the episode, but just sitting here and watching it as a single episode and trying to rate it, I just felt, you know, 3.5. It's really solid. I really enjoyed it. It's things going on. But it didn't have the same satisfaction of a self-contained episode for me for some reason. I think the lack of coming off of a big cliffhanger and the lack of going to a big cliffhanger just took the slightest bit away from it for me.
Yeah, I think for once, since a long time, we're going to have pretty much agreeing opinions here. I'm giving it a 3.5 as well. I mean, it's continuing the idea that they put forth in the first episode. We get a little bit more character development for Lee Nalis. We get the collusion and the collusion between Wynn and Minister Jarrow. We get great character moments from them. But essentially, it's just the middle part of a three-part series of episodes, and it's not really a placeholder. Things happen in it. Things are building up. But usually endings and beginnings are far more entertaining than the middle part. And this middle part is just, it's good, but it's nothing really outstanding. So 3.5 for me as well.
It almost seems unfair to say, yeah, it's nothing outstanding. 3.5.
Well, yeah,
I always feel like we're putting it down.
Well, we're not. It's a good episode of a good series, but I think it just shows how consistently good this show was.
Mm-hmm. We haven't really had, I don't know what we're going to be looking at throughout the rest of the episode, but so far, if this is an example of what we're going to be seeing in the rest of this season, I'm looking forward to this season probably even more than the first one. So, and there you go. All right, well, with ratings out of the way, do we want to do some emails?
Mm-hmm. Incoming transmission.
All right, we'll delve into the email sack then. Our first email tonight is from Gene Hendricks, who is our loyal listener. I think we've all decided.
One of the three.
One of the three. No, four.
Four. Yes, four.
Sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful ship, if memory serves. Gene emailed in Sean, Paul, and Andy. As Giles. I like that. And Andy as Rick. That works as well. Especially given the Casablanca nature of Deep Space Nine. As long as I get the and, I'm happy. Guess what? The breakout character they wanted is back. You know, I liked O'Brien in The Next Generation. Admit he was the character that I was most excited about when the series started, but boy, was this painful to watch. Bashir is actually not the most annoying character, thanks to O'Brien being childish. Oh, I wasn't saying anything to you. And whiny. I never wanted to be a storyteller, so why try and do a good job? It might be the start of the O'Brien-Bashir relationship, but this was a really bad episode to begin it in. As for the I'm a child in charge of a group, but I have to be a complete bitch to prove I'm worthy story, it seems like this has been done to death. Plus, as you all said, the switch from annoying brat to sympathetic child really got flipped too fast. It was amusing with the oatmeal prank, but there wasn't much decent there beyond that. True, Jake says how much he admires his father, but that could be done anywhere, so it wasn't integral to the plot. I can't even see this working as a Next Generation plot, even in the first season. I just don't think there's enough here. Gene. But should we talk about that before we go to his PSs?
Yeah, I can't.
I agree.
I was going to say I agree. I think, but that's the limitation of a single story, and I don't think that the story of the girl, you know, having to be the leader of her group fighting against this other group could be extended out to a multi-part story. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. You can tell this sort of one-off story with this character and not really have that much development and be it boring and, you know, be kind of not getting all that much character development, or you can draw it out over a couple of episodes and it be relatively uninteresting and boring and you really don't care all that much about the character. So it's
no.
Really?
I'm not accepting that. That's okay. To me, that's a cop-out. We told a story that can't be interesting. Well, then don't tell that story. We've seen this so many times on so many different series where you see a similar story that's been told many times. I think we've seen it at points on this one, although I'm a little I'm having a little tough time coming up with an example on my mind, but I think off the top of my head. But I think we've seen it in this series too, where you see a story that's kind of cliched, you've seen it before, but it's done in a way where it's new and interesting, or it's just done where the acting is so well done that it grabs you and holds you. This episode didn't have that. I think we disagreed a little bit when we on the nature of that plot line when we did the episode initially, and I guess we still do. I don't think you could say, you know, oh, you can't do this in one episode and it would be boring if you did it in three. If that If those are your only two choices, then don't tell this episode.
All right, fair enough.
And I think there is third choice that we didn't mention is tell it in an interesting way.
Well, Gene has a PS. As far as the Next Generation films go, I think that Insurrection is the best of them. Not only is it a character study, which I like, but it felt like a Next Generation plot. Yeah, you could always watch old episodes, but this was the idea that they were continuing adventures on a larger scale. Of course, in comparison, you have Generations, which is really a Kirk movie. First Contact, which said, yeah, we could watch the appropriate episode of the original series, but we'd rather not bother. And Nemesis, which tried to do Data sacrificing himself and then completely undercut it with the memory download. So I might be damning with faint praise, though. PPS, I would love it if there was a new TV show, Netflix or otherwise, with a new crew in any time period. However, I would make it a requirement that the script editor had to sit down and watch every episode and movie, animated included, produced to date, and force them to take notes. One of the things we tried to do with the Tales of the Seventh Fleet was connect the movies to the Next Generation and show the transition in tech, crew, etc. But of course, we did it with a new ship and a new crew. Thanks, Gene. If you want to listen to what we thought about a number of the Next Generation episodes, well, we did a Palace of Glittering Delights about it, so go and listen to that.
Mm-hmm. I think we had some positive things to say about both Generations and Insurrection. I think we, you know, I think we said very positive and glowing things about that. Nemesis, well, we didn't cover that.
We didn't cover that.
And we didn't cover First Contact.
Yeah. So.
We can cover First Contact now if you want.
Peek behind the scenes, we've got another episode to record, so we'll be covering First Contact another time. if you want, I'll go ahead and take the episode from Paul, or take the email from Paul.
Okay.
All right. This one is from Paul in Greensboro. It's titled Episode 14. He says, on the mom pants thing. It also bugs the hell out of me that they have Terry Farrell in that severe hairstyle all the time. Just because she's a science officer, she has to have frumpy hair? I guess it was just a happy coincidence that Nicole DeBoer is half-elf, okay? And so she looks super cute in short hair. Not that Trek is about eye candy, but the fashion choices are often frustratingly unflattering. And that comes from Paul in Greensboro. So do we think that a lot of times that even though that they have these really attractive female characters in Star Trek, they put them in frumpy clothes or give them awful hair designs? Is that...
I think it's, you know, it's Kira's outfit that she wears when she takes her jacket off is quite unflattering. So I get what he's saying about that one. That, like in this episode we just watched, I think it's because the pants just come so high up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really suit her. Yeah, they don't really suit her, so...
Yeah,
but I think it's a case of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, you're doing a show about a military ship, and you're not going to dress particularly sexy or do your hair in a sexy way in that setting. You're going to do, you know, things in a utilitarian way, which kind of fits what Terry Farrell's hair... You know, what's done with her hair in the show. Now... Would she be more attractive if she had her hair down? Yeah, we've seen her with her hair down. We know that she is. But if you show her the way she is on the show now, then you start saying, well, you know, she's so much prettier than what we see. She's so much sexier than what we see. But if you sex her up, then people are going to say, oh, yeah, look, you know, they're just treating her as an object and she really isn't, you know, serving a function. And nobody on a ship would have her hair like that. You know what I mean? You see, you can't win, really.
Well, and I think it's an interesting contrast if you look at The Next Generation and the character of Deanna Troi. For the first couple of seasons, they had her in that sort of low-cut top that showed off some cleavage, and she didn't have a specific sort of regulation hairstyle, but she really didn't do anything for me. It's when she finally got into a uniform and had a more regulated or more regulation look that I thought... her attractiveness level went up. So yeah, it is kind of, I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder, I guess. So
what we've learned this episode is that women in uniform do it for Paul. No, for sure. So.
Yes.
They may do it for Paul as well, I don't know.
I'll keep that to myself.
All right then. Well, thank you both for writing in, both Paul and Gene. We really appreciate the emails. We'll be getting to more emails next time out. The email address, again, is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. Write in and tell us what you think about the show. Tell us what you think about what we're doing, and we'd love to read it on the next episode. And speaking of next episode, Andy?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, it's the conclusion of the Circle Trilogy. Will it live up to the hype, or be a bit of a damp squib? Tune in next week and find out.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. See you later. Bye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
This is a weird question, and it's been bugging me, and I don't know, you know, take it for what you will, and I don't know actually how to kind of address this. Well, it's because...
Spit it out, man.
All right. Because in America, we call people who are of African descent and are colored, you know, we call them African Americans. But we used to just identify them as they're black people. But we've used this sort of euphemism of African Americans to be a sort of political correct thing. What do they call people who are of color in Great Britain or in the UK? I mean,
I have no idea anymore.
Okay. Because I'm saying, you know, you can't call them African Americans because if they're living in the UK, they're not American. Do you call them African Europeans? It's one of these things that just, and the reason I'm talking about this.
The world wants to know.
The reason I'm talking about this, I just recently watched or rewatched an episode of The Venture Brothers. Have you guys ever seen that show?
I'm aware of it. I don't think I've watched it.
Okay. Well, there's this one episode where this group of people who are basically sort of this D-list superhero team are applying to the League of Calamitous Intent to try and get an arch nemesis. And one of the guys on the hero team is this guy called Jefferson Twilight. And he's a Blackula hunter. Basically, he's Blade. He's kind of like an analog for Blade, except instead of fighting vampires, he fights Blackulas, or black vampires. And one of the people who's auditioning to be their arch nemesis says, well, don't you mean African-American vampires? And he goes, no, because sometimes I kill Blackulas who live in Europe, so I fight Blackulas. So I was just, the conversation came up about that, and... It's been bugging me.
I have no idea anymore.
Okay, well.
We've actually had that situation come up at work.
About Blackulas?
No.
you know, and Milo Manara is actually a damn good artist if you look his stuff up. I mean, if you're deathly afraid of nudity, don't look his stuff up. But if it doesn't bother you, he's a brilliant artist.
I do fear nudity.
Well, don't look up his work then.
I only fear my own nudity, so that's
oh, that's not what we were talking about?
Yeah, you should fear my own nudity as well, please.
And mine.
Well, thankfully we don't have cameras.